veteran pitchers who can't throw strikes, and a coaching staff who are stuck in the past? Is it already over for the Diamondbacks starters in 2026? Or is this all part of a Tori Lavello master plan? We're answering all of these questions and more right now on the T-Backs podcast.
Baseball is back.
Perdomo makes the play.
And a high fly ball. No doubt about this. Corbin Marte.
They're going to send them all the way around. Corbin Carroll with an inside the park. Back.
It's Alec Thomas from the Diamondbacks.
Former Major League Baseball player Luis Gonzalez.
I'm Tori Lavello, and you're listening to the T-Backs Podcast.
T-Backs Podcast.
T-Backs Podcast.
Arizona's number one baseball and beverage podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the T-Backs Podcast, where we bring you all the hottest Arizona Diamondbacks tea and talk from across the pond here in London. And perhaps this week, I'm going to need something a little stronger than tea in my mug today. Because today we're going to be leveling some very hard questions at the front office and the coaching staff of the Arizona Diamondbacks at the close of what could easily be described as a disastrous 2 weeks for the Diamondbacks. As I sit down to record this, we're sitting a game below 500, heading into a road trip three games above 500. We've lost four on the bounce, with two losses of over 10 runs coming in Milwaukee and coming off the back of receiving a three-game sweep in the Windy City at the hands of the Chicago Cubs. That is obviously not good for anybody, but what's worse for me is how fragile and ineffective the pitching has seemed through that stretch. So grab your beverage of choice. Let's get into it. Don't get me wrong. The offense hasn't been great either. They definitely have to pick up their productivity soon. Otherwise, we are going to be in big trouble. But I really am beginning to wonder whether there is no possible fix for the mess that is Diamondbacks pitching. Looking at Baseball Reference right now will tell you a very ugly truth, that the current ERA for this pitching staff at 5.07 is the worst we've ever had since the 110 loss season in 2021, and the third worst all-time in franchise history. Now, I know that, yes, there is a big difference between judging an end-of-season ERA against a current one just 33 games into the season, but yeah, with a lot of baseball left to play, we're still not good enough. You don't need to be a baseball savant to see that something has got to change if this roster is aiming to be a team that competes. So let's start at the bottom and work our way up. And this is where I'm going to have to hold my hands up and say, you guys, I was wrong when we re-signed Merrill Kelly. I said it was good. It wasn't. In spite of the fact that his age, we gave him a hefty pay rise at the start of the year, and I thought it was a pretty sensible decision. You know, he's Merrill the mainstay. He's always reliable as a number two or three guy, and at times it really does seem like he's got stuff to be the ace of this rotation. But this signing at the start of the season, promptly followed by the announcement he's going to be given the opening day start in Los Angeles, honestly, that filled me with confidence. How very wrong, though, was I? An intercostal nerve injury saw him pulled from the rotation, and after two rehabilitation starts in Reno, he came back to the rotation and something was just off about him. In four starts so far in 2026, he's 1-3 with a rapidly ballooning ERA of 9.95, accompanied by a career-high 13.7 hits per nine and a career-low 6.6 strikeouts per nine. Something just isn't there for Merrill right now, whatever it is. And whatever that thing is that he's lost, seemingly the coaching staff can't find it either. And that's really where I've got the biggest axe to grind. Re-signing Merrill this past winter was likely a decision that had a lot of different voices from different people on the pitching staff all in favor of bringing him back. Otherwise, it simply wouldn't have happened. After the trade deadline last year, we saw what a Diamondbacks starting rotation without Merrill Kelly in it looked like. And, you know, it was fine. It wasn't anything special, but it really wasn't a disaster either. And then after we picked up Mike Soroka for what is effectively peanuts during the offseason, many of us, myself included, came to terms with the fact that that might spell the end of any hopes for a Merrill Kelly return. And it took some time. I went through the stages of grief and, you know, grief, sadness, disbelief, rage, maybe a chair got thrown out the window. But after several cups of tea and a calm down and think about it, I was okay with it. But his 4.23 ERA in Texas last year after posting 3.22 with the D-backs before the trade maybe was more of a hint than we thought that Merrill's best days were rapidly fading into the past behind him. And it only gets worse when you really start digging into the metrics. You know, I am a big fan of pitchers who can mix it up, throw a lot of different pitches at different times. You know, just look at how often I tweet about Yumin Lin in Reno. But with Merrill's six-pitch arsenal, I am really struggling to find something that seems really effective this year. His go-to pitches are the changeup and the four-seamer. He's throwing the changeup as his most common pitch for the first time in his career, likely since he can't rely on other pitches' velocity as he ages. But that is a pointless change without coming with control. And given in half of his starts this year, he's thrown over 100 pitches, but has exited both of those in the fifth inning. It shows that there's a lack of effectiveness in the pitch selection there, but also, and perhaps more importantly, a lack of confidence in the pitch selection. And the other thing that I've noticed is that historically Merrill's performance is the change in his arm angle sometimes. The past couple of years has seen his arm angle steadily decrease from 31 degrees when he first arrived at the Diamondbacks from the SK Wyverns at the KBO down to 24 degrees at the moment. And the largest points at which he made these changes were when he came back from his big injury in 2024, and that is concerning to me, because in my eyes, it looks like he's still figuring out how to pitch comfortably with his arm in the condition it's in now, and that is after 8 seasons in the big leagues. That really is not something we can afford to be letting him figure out as we go through the season, and it's an issue that any scouting team worth their tuppence would have identified before re-signing him as a free agent this offseason, right? Now, I am not claiming to be a baseball insider, but a veteran pitcher who was deemed surplus to retirements at the previous trade deadline, who had big drop-offs in both velocity and control in the past 6 months, in all likelihood wouldn't be considered for $20 million a year in any other organization in the major leagues. Even the Dodgers, who, you know, just piss money everywhere, wouldn't do that unless there were big, big promises and incentives put on the table by their agent. Now, I will take into account that Merrill turned down more money supposedly from the Giants and the Padres to return to Arizona with the D-backs and sign with his hometown team, and we love him for that. He's one of my favorite players, but so far we haven't gotten the Merrill Kelly we were promised in return for our $40 million, and this points to a critical failing, and that's a divide between what our front offices think they're signing versus what we end up receiving. Look at the Jordan Montgomery signing, for example. We signed him 2 days before opening day, committed $50 million towards him on the words of Scott Boras, then 2 small stints on the IL, and just 2 starts later, he goes on a generationally bad run. And that's 19 starts, 6.44 ERA on 95 innings, sent to the bullpen, finished the season with a 6.23 ERA, and then never makes a start again, becoming part of last year's Tommy John surgery epidemic. Now, when Ken Kendrick comes out and calls a signing horrible, you know it's pretty bad. But as far as I can find out, there's never been a reason given for why the front office was convinced to sign Montgomery other than the usual. He's been a great veteran pitcher for other teams, and we want to wring the last baseball out of him before he retires. And that has worked just great for us in the past. Just ask Madison Bumgarner. Now, I know about the Arizona retirement home thing. And having driven to Costco in Deer Valley the day before Thanksgiving, I know with confidence that the state of Arizona already has too many people past their prime. So why does the front office keep signing players who are like that? Our so-called bargain bucket signings, who aren't 1,000 years old, and Mike Soroka is the example of this, have done pretty well. His 4.7 ERA this year isn't great, but it comes with a 4-1 record and comparable strikeouts of bases on ball rates to his 2019 All-Star campaign. And at age 23, he also has plenty left in the tank. He proves that affordable quality is out there to find if we look for it. So if I could get any answers from the front office right now, I'd most want to know why veterans keep getting upwards of $15 million AAV from us, only to turn their formerly elite pitching arms into either limp noodles, or why they just ride off into the sunset in retirement and pocket all of our cash in the process. But that's not all. You thought this rant was over? Well, you'd be right. But unfortunately, if your name is Mike Hazen, Torrey Lovello, or Brian Kaplan, I've got an entirely different topic that I'm equally annoyed about, And that is how this organization manages to mismanage and ruin young pitching talent too. Now, with the likes of Justin Martinez, I understand that players get injured, and Tommy John is common for players that throw 100 miles an hour plus. The same goes for guys like Christian Mayner. But how this organization has managed to take Brandon Fart, the guy who was so incredibly effective in the 2023 postseason in LA and Philly, who put up 24 wins in the last 2 years, and turn him into statistically the worst pitcher in the clubhouse, posting far above league average chase and groundout rates, is a mystery to me. Like Merrill, Brandon this year has made off-speed their most used pitch type, working their curveball 22% of the time, and a sinker that complements that 20% of the time. The added cutter this year looked very effective at times as well. However, that devastating sweeper that we grew so used to watching as it wiped out right-handed batters has lost all of its fizz this year. Before he moved to the pen, he had an ERA of 5.94, which is pretty disastrous given how many would have expected him to right some of the wrongs of last year and push on towards that middle-of-the-rotation mainstay role we all sort of assumed he would turn out with. And you know, that move to the bullpen wasn't exactly a controversial one, given that, you know, it was the corresponding move for Merrill coming back up. However, if we look at it in hindsight, was it the correct one? Of course, Mike Soroka's electric form meant that his status as a signing, primarily envisioned as a long relief option, was quickly rewritten. But if you were going to send a starting pitcher from the rotation to the pen this year, why was it not Ryan Nelson? He's currently 1-3 on the year, with an ERA over 6 in 7 starts, and again, that's not exactly numbers worthy of untouchable status. He's already been sent to the pen once in his career, and last year 10 of his 33 total outings out of the pen en route to finishing 2025 with a 3.39 ERA and a 7-3 record gave him a 1.27 ERA plus, making him the best overall 2025 Diamondbacks pitcher, which really was widely attributed to his reinvention during his time in the pen. By sending Brandon to the bullpen, I hope that we're thinking we're going to achieve something similar. But it seems like we are hoping that he too will blossom without the pressure of taking the ball every 5 days on his shoulder. But if what you wanted out of this was just an effective bullpen arm, why not consider putting in the likes of Cade Stroud, who, down on the farm in Reno in the hitter-friendly PCL, is currently 2-0 through an 11.2 inning stretch, only giving up 2 earned runs, 13 Ks, and he owns a 1.54 ERA. And if what you wanted was simply effective long relief from the guys you've already got Taylor Clark and Juan Murillo. Now, they're not exactly perfect, but I would argue they're better candidates for that role than wasting a currently stretched out arm like Brandon Fart and ultimately potentially damaging his development by making him pitch irregular and unpredictably scheduled days. Now, all of that aside, Brandon is a professional. He is very level-headed. The only thing he said when asked about what he thought about being moved from the rotation to the pen is, "I just want to win baseball games." And yeah, well, so do I. And I think that given Torrey's comments about the plan for Brandon being to simply go as hard as you can for as long as you can, I'm not happy with that. Obviously, Torrey can't go into too many specifics. He can't give too many things away for future opponents, but it almost seems like there's no real strategy here. He's put Brandon in the pen as what is really the easiest decision he can make at face value, and is hoping that, seemingly by osmosis, just Brandon being there will magically fix all the issues that he's had this year. Now, Brandon was part of the problem. He was contributing to the Diamondbacks' starting pitcher's struggles to complete 5 innings, and yes, he was one of the ones who have frequently been blown up for multiple runs in the first inning of their appearances. And our pitching first inning ERA on its own is an abysmal 8.18, the worst in the majors. So, where is the solution? Well, one of my favorite sources when coming up to stuff about Yap About on the show is our old friend Alex D'Agostino from Sports Illustrated, who has floated the idea of Torrey pivoting to using an opener to simultaneously ease up the load on the bullpen, take the pressure off our starters who keep soiling themselves in the first inning, and ultimately make everybody happier. And I love the sound of everybody getting along and being happy in the Diamondbacks fandom. So here's what they've suggested. Our bullpen ERA ranks 25th in the majors, while the starting rotation ERA ranks last in the majors at 5.42. If we take away the earned runs off of position players like James McCann and the DFA'd guy, Joe Ross, who, frankly, the less said about him, the better, it becomes 4.16, which would rank 16th in the majors. And the point behind all of that is the Diamondbacks have some surprisingly sturdy long relief options. So even beyond the group of high leverage guys, So your lone left-hander, Brandon Garcia, for example, could be utilized against a tough left-hand heavy lineup, similar to the one we're about to face in the Pittsburgh Pirates tonight, with the likes of O'Neill Cruz and Ryan O'Hearn kicking us off at 2 a.m. Great Britain time. OP, I love me an early morning start. We also have other names like Jonathan Loaiziga or, you know, even Brandon Fart, as ironic as that might be, utilized as potential openers, which would also still preserve the Juan Murillo, Ryan Thompson, Paul Sewell group of the late inning high leverage guys. Now, that's definitely not a perfectly reliable group of bullpen guys. We've already seen how, once again, the pitching coaches take, you know, a talented guy like Andrew Hoffman, who was putting up an ERA around 3 in Kansas before we traded for him, and then magically have overnight managed to make a guy who enters the game in Milwaukee, supposed to deliver 2 innings and give the beleaguered pen a break, and instead recording 1 out, 11 batters faced, allowing 8 hits and 8 runs. But I think the worse that this gets, the more we have to really start thinking laterally. We got to get outside the baseball traditionalist box. We got to start, you know, maybe blooding younger guys early. Give them a taste of major league action while we still have minor league options to spare on them. Bullpen guys like Taylor Rashi, Felix Abner, Dre Jameson, Bryce Jarvis, Yulba Diaz even notwithstanding, I think it's high time we get guys like Mitch Brett and Cole Drake involved as soon as possible. Yeah, it's going to be a steep learning curve for them, but if we are going to make something of 2026, I am fine with adopting a sink or swim attitude. That's what we did with Jose Fernandez, and he's turned out just fine. Ultimately, like the takeaway that I really want from this episode that has really just turned into more of two quite extended rants for me is that this Diamondbacks team needs to take risks, but at the same time, they also don't need to reinvent the wheel. Like every other team in baseball at some point or another has figured out this year how to have a reliable bullpen apart from us. And I don't know whether that's just because we thought, oh, we don't need any lefties to start the year, or, oh, who we have is good enough if we just need to bring in a late inning guy. Oh, let's re-sign Paul Sewald. Let's get him out of the old folks home. Sewald really has been fine. It's looking more like the general philosophy and the general psychology behind what our pitching, especially relief pitching, but now starting to creep into the starters too, where just everybody's going to crap the bed at some point. That happens, but why do we do it so much more than anybody else? Every other organization in the major league has managed to do this. Why haven't we? And I think that the more that this is the product that we're putting out on the mound, playing baseball in the major leagues, the more damage it's going to do to our franchise. Like, this is a team that, you know, we know can play some good baseball when they're enjoying themselves, when they're having a good atmosphere, good vibes. Like, I'm a little bit sick of just, oh, I'm happy that we signed so-and-so because of we have the best clubhouse vibes. Like, that's great from a fandom perspective that you have people we can root for, people that we can connect to. But if they're not going to do anything out on the field, then why are we dropping, you know, more money than vast majority of people will ever learn in their lifetime on a player that's just not going to be up to scratch? I don't understand it. And it's a thing that seems to be happening more with the Diamondbacks than anybody else. And that might just be because I pay more attention to the Diamondbacks than anybody else. But I really don't see, you know, the Yankees or the Dodgers going and signing a guy for, you know, an absolute shedload of money, and then immediately he's completely different to, like, when they signed him. Like, even, let's go with a guy like Giancarlo Stanton. Yeah, he's injured all the frickin' time, but when he's not, he still hits absolute bombs most of the time. You take somebody like Nolan Arenado, for example. He's only just figured out how to hit a major league pitch, and it's 30 games into the season, and he's finally having a hitting streak. Speaking of hitting streaks, Ildemar Vargas just had a 20-game hit streak and won National League Player of the Month or whatever it is, and I didn't even talk about it in this podcast because I was so damn angry because none of our guys know how to throw a baseball between a zone between the belt and the knees over a bit of clay in some dirt. That's, you know, fundamental stuff about being a baseball pitcher. How come you can walk down to, like, Finsbury Park in London now, a place that's never really been much of a home for baseball, and you can see a guy who knows how to throw a strike, and yet the guy we're giving $20 million a year can't do that because he's going to retire and just go and do the farewell victory tour of Arizona State University. Forks up, shout out ASU, but what the hell, guys? Why on earth is this our philosophy on how we're going to run our Major League Baseball team? I'm not here for that. I'm not okay with that. So ultimately, yeah, this has turned into a bit of a therapy session for me, a bit of a rant. But thank you very much for listening anyway, especially if you've stuck around that entire time. Put out in the comments if you're watching this at, what, 20 minutes timestamp on this, give or take? Yeah, let's all go get therapy together, and hopefully the ad revenue will cover the cost of my actual therapist at some point. Anyway, before I go down that particular tangent, I want to say thank you very much, as always, for listening. Please remember to like, subscribe, or wherever it is that you're tuning in from. We're always very happy to have you here. Please make sure that you support the channel over on socials. We have Instagram, we have X, that's at TBAX Podcast, where we generally throw probably kind of terrible baseball opinions out into the world in the hope that anybody cares about them. But you can also follow us on at TBAX on TikTok, which is where I post about what the life of being a baseball fan in Great Britain is like. And honestly, it can get pretty wild. So make sure you don't miss those either. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to wrap it up for now. Thanks very much. We'll see you on the next one. Goodbye.